Welcome to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Your host, Carl Nordgren, will teach you how to take an expansive view on what it means to be creative and entrepreneurial. Carl is an entrepreneur, novelist, and a lifelong student. For 20 years, he has been learning how to help folks grow their creative capacities. Now, here's Carl.
Hello and welcome. Happy Sunday. This is Carl Nordgren. You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius on 97.9 The Hill. What the best radio station in the state 6 years in a row. I think on that by now, all the snowstorms, all the winter storms that challenged us are all past us. I hope you weathered them well. Our family did, and we even had some fun with the snow that happened last weekend. Today, in this show that talks about creativity, talks about how important creativity is, refuses to define creativity, I'm going to focus on story. I have shared a couple of episodes with you in the past. This, by the way, is episode 149. What does that mean? That means that next week when I'm in the studio, I can't believe it, I get to record show number 150, and I'm going to tell you right now it's going to be about love. Because I love this show, I love the folks here, and it'll be just, I think, a day or two after Valentine's Day. So I'm here with Flicka, and today we're going to talk about story. When I was 9 years old, I had three ambitions for my life. I wanted to be shortstop for the Chicago Cubs, a position that at the time was held by my favorite ball player, my favorite athlete of all time, Ernie Banks. I wanted to be a fishing guide, and I wanted to be a novelist. And so how's two out of three? Not bad for a batting average. Two out of three. I've been a fishing guide. I was all through my teenage years into my early 20s. I'm a novelist. So two out of three. When Duke asked me back in 2002 if I would come teach a class in entrepreneurship, my first reaction after I said yes, my first reaction was to go look at my entrepreneurial experiences and see what I could learn, see what lessons I could glean from that. And it was just so clear that when the startups that I worked on were successful, it was because I was in the position of being the storyteller for the company and I had come up with appropriate narratives to serve the company. Sometimes those were internal narratives that told us the best of us, that shared with us what kind of organization we needed to be and captured stories and vignettes and examples of that. And I would tell those stories to us about the wonderful organization we are becoming. And some were external stories, that stories designed to, you know, shape the marketplace's view on what is happening. And I'll give you a couple of examples of that that I did in business, that I did in my entrepreneurial career just a little bit later in the show. I want to talk a little bit about – still talk a little bit about story generally. I learned about – story without knowing that I was learning about story's leadership powers when I was, in fact, a 15-year-old fishing guide up in northwestern Ontario in the wilderness up there, where I, as a 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old kid, would be guiding 50 and 60-year-old men, very successful men, bank presidents, owners of manufacturing facilities. And so how is a 15-year-old kid going to lead people who are used to telling others what to do? And I learned, as I said, without knowing that I learned it, that when I controlled the narrative for the day, when I could lay down a narrative track that captured the wonder of what we're doing here, the authentic version, yes, it had to be authentic. I could exaggerate and use hyperbole, but I always wanted to be authentic version of what we are doing, the most beautiful version of what we were doing, then increasingly, as the men in my boat were listening to me. Increasingly, that listening was, you know, sort of transformed into following my voice, doing what I was asking us to do. And all of a sudden, I would, in fact, by the end of the first day, certainly by the second day of our fishing, I would be in charge. And I got that authority by telling the story of the day. When I began to teach, at Duke, I found that some folks would become more confident about story if I sort of lifted story out of the artistic understanding of story, right? So the novelist understanding. These folks didn't have to become novelists, I wanted to assure them. And I found that if I were to treat story as the one and only universal knowledge management technology that my students had more confidence in their ability to master story, and it, in fact, is those things. It's universal. Story is universal. We all know story. We have all told stories. We've all been told stories that shaped our lives. I could talk about story for an hour, and throughout that hour, you would be saying to yourself, I think I knew that about story. I think I knew that about story. That doesn't surprise me about story. We all know about story. We've lived our full lives surrounded by and telling stories. It's knowledge management because it adds context, story does, and it adds emotion, story does, to the facts and the information that's being shared. And that emotion creates a really important scaffolding so that the facts and the events that are being shared with you have a place to, you know, to rest, and we can find relationships between them more effectively when we have that emotional scaffolding in place. So it turns information into knowledge, this knowledge management technology does, and it is, in fact, a technology. It organizes. It stores. It transmits this information. So it's a technology. It's the one and only universal knowledge management technology, and I find that a lot of folks, when they can see it as such, have much more confidence in their ability to master story for its creative and its entrepreneurial powers. And they should master it because I tell you what, story is an insistent technology. It demands, story does, it demands that it be part of. If a boss were to bring us all together and share some information with us, right, share some events with us, without putting it in the context of a story, without putting this information or these facts into the context of a story, the first thing we're going to do when the boss leaves the room is we're going to create a story that helps us understand this, understand why this is important, understand its significance to us. So it's a leadership's responsibility. You might even say it's their duty to provide us with a story that helps us understand the changes, the events that are occurring in an organization. Neuroscientists have found that when somebody shares just a bit of information with you, your brain reacts in really very basic fashion. Just a little part of the brain lights up to understand and absorb that information. It's a really limited part of the brain that lights up when you're told just some information. But put that same information in the context of a story, and our whole brains light up. The comprehension improves. Retention and memory improves. There's a little dopamine blast, which sort of is not only makes us feel good, it's also sort of gets us incrementally closer to taking action. So take a moment and take that information and put it in the context of a story and then share it, and you'll just be serving the folks that are listening. Folks, we're at a break here now, coming back from the break, and I'm going to give you a couple of examples of how I've used story in entrepreneurial settings.
You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius with Carl Nordgren. Welcome back to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Here's your host, Carl Nordgren.
Welcome back. Thanks for coming back. This is Carl Nordgren. You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius. In the first segment of the show, I introduced the topic story and talked about story from some sort of background perspectives about how a story will engage the whole brain in the way that a piece of information will not. I also talked about how in my entrepreneurial career, I use story for both its internal and its external values. And so let's give you an example. I was part of the team that started Cellular One of the Triangle back in 1985. Anybody around here then, you'll remember Cellular launched in 1985. For folks who weren't around, let me remind you that cellular service started in our country as a local market business. The FCC licensed two companies in each metropolitan service area. One of those licenses went to the existing telephone company. The FCC was determined to bring competition into the telecommunications world, so one license was set aside for the entrepreneurial entrant. That was us. we were competing against Sprint in the Triangle back in 1985. Because we had limited marketing budgets, I decided that we really needed to be big somewhere. Cellular phones were costing $5,000. Airtime was five, six, seven, eight times more expensive than it is now. And so it dawned, it hit me. It was an insight. I didn't study this. It just was an insight that the folks that were going to be most likely to be the earliest adopters of cellular service would be the folks that would see this as an investment, not as a purchase, but as an investment. They're investing in their business at that price point. And that's going to be real estate people, right? When they're in the office, they're away from their world, their working world. When they're out in their working world, they're away from communications. So I thought to myself, let's just really focus on real estate professions. And we did. But initially, when I went out, as our system was being built, and it took about half a year, not quite that long, but it took a while, a few months for our system to be built. And during that time, I'm out. I'm not an engineer, so I didn't have a role in making the network come together. I was out in the field, and I was spending as much time as I possibly could with folks from the real estate professions, as many leaders, as many brokers, as many developers, as many appraisers, just as many real estate people as I could. And initially, I was really disappointed when I would take these folks out for a coffee or take them out for lunch, and I would tell them all about cellular service and how cool it was going to be. And I had this great story about all the features and benefits of cellular service, and they weren't interested. And they told me they weren't interested. They said things to me like, Nordgren, I've been really quite successful without cellular. Others would say, oh, you put a phone in my car, you're taking away from me that last private place I can be where I can go think my own thoughts. After they finished listening to me and showed respectful disinterest in me, they would then get really excited when they would talk about themselves, when they would talk about what they've done here in the Triangle. 1985 was when we were just reaching critical mass of becoming the Triangle, and these men and women that I was speaking with were the folks that were making this happen, and they were so proud of their accomplishment. I could hear that pride and that enthusiasm and that appreciation for what they had done, and I heard it for what they thought was coming, for what they expected was coming. So it took me a week, maybe 2 weeks, for me to figure out, okay, here's what I need to do. Here's what I need to do. I'm going to go out now and talk to real estate people, and I'm going to tell them their story. I'm going to reflect back to them the stories that I've been hearing from the individual real estate people, and I'm going to bring that together into a narrative, and I'm going to bring this narrative back to these real estate people and talk about what you have done as part of this wonderful industry to make the Triangle this extraordinary place that it is. And now that I've attracted their attention by being attractive to them, right? I'm telling them things that attract their attention to me because they are attracted to these stories, these vignettes. Now that I had their attention, I realized that now's the time to make a promise in my story that I can make their life even better. And it worked. We had a dominant market share by telling the real estate people the story that they loved and by helping them see how investing in cellular phones and service will make it more likely that they can continue to be successful. So that's sort of the external marketplace use of story. Internally, we crafted a story about we were going to be the quality service and value company and that had important internal implications. We were all about serving our customers. We were all about serving each other. And we had an ongoing narrative about who we were going to become the most extraordinary company that the Triangle had ever seen. Those stories were continually updated. At the time, there was this management idea of management by walking around. I took that idea and I said, okay, I'm going to be leading by walking around telling stories. I'm going to find Janet doing something that's consistent with our internal story, and then I'm going to go over to the other part of the company and tell everybody what Janet is doing that's consistent, the story of Janet that is consistent with the bigger story that we're trying to tell. And it worked really, really well. We were an extraordinary group of people. Years later, people were so excited that they were part of this group of people who felt so good about what they were doing and could talk about it. Well, because of our success, we went out and we got, I think, about a dozen more licenses all throughout the Southeast. We had, so we could build systems in Greensboro and in Charleston and in Savannah and lots of other markets all throughout the Southeast. And what we realized was that our story did a really good job of serving us here in the Triangle, but, you know, Charleston ain't quite like the Triangle. So what we came up with was the idea that here's a few core elements to our story, just a few core elements. We hand those core elements off to the leaders of the other markets and say, just stay true to these core elements and let the story evolve, let the story develop, let the story emerge that's best for your community, for your market. And it worked. We had the dominant market share throughout. It reminds me of I came across just a couple of years ago a Scottish patriot and writer from the late 1700s, a gentleman named Andrew Fletcher. And Andrew Fletcher's quote is, I'm paraphrasing here, but I'm pretty close to it. And he said, if I could write the ballads for a nation, I wouldn't care at all who wrote the laws. And if we can for a moment agree that a ballad is just simply a story set to music, and we can then take this idea and apply it to what we did at Cellular One, right? We had a core story, and we didn't care what, you know, what decisions they made underneath that core story as long as they were consistent with the qualities of that core story. So we're going to come on. When you come on back, we're going to tell you a couple more stories about story, a couple more insights into story. Please come on back.
You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius with Carl Nordgren. Welcome back to Exploring Your Creative Genius. Here's your host, Carl Nordgren.
Welcome back. Thanks for coming back. This is Carl Nordgren. You're listening to Exploring Your Creative Genius on 97.9 The Hill. I've been talking to you today about the creative and entrepreneurial powers of stories. Let me tell you for just a quick second about one of my novels, my very first novel, The 53rd Parallel. The 53rd Parallel was my first novel that comes out of my experiences in Canada as a fishing guide, along with my fascination with the early days of the IRA in Ireland, and the 53rd Parallel brings those two worlds together. And why do I mention it now? I mention it now because just a couple of days ago I learned from Amazon that it is for sale for just 99 cents. The e-reader version of it is for sale for just 99 cents. I have a little hesitancy promoting this because I have never in my life purchased anything from Amazon. But my book is there, available for just 99 cents, The 53rd Parallel. A type of story that I have used and I have studied in my new book that's coming out in June uses this construct are aspirational stories, stories that make changes happen. And leaders can use aspirational stories to intentionally make changes happen. And the way I see an aspirational story is it has three parts. Let's say we're going to try to convince an organization that it's time to go through some really transformative changes. At the very beginning of this, at the very beginning of this aspirational story, at the beginning of this transformative effort, at the very beginning, there needs to be a common understanding of where we are right now, of the current situation. There has to be an agreement there at the beginning. We all have to be understanding each other, linking arms together for our understanding, or we won't be able to move together successfully unless we start together. So at the very beginning, there needs to be a common understanding that the leader shares with us about what the current situation is. Now, clearly, the leader can identify those events and those dynamics that are happening now. They're going to be, you know, sort of pointers to, head starts towards, teeing up where we want to go. But they have to be true. They have to be authentic. Right, they can be selected and edited, but they have to be authentic. They have to be true. We all have to agree that yes, indeed, this is what's going on right now. So there's where we begin. Then we have the grand finale that we wanted to have a wonderful story about where we're headed, that better place we're going to be, that better organization we're going to be. Right, we want to dramatize that extraordinary place. And in that dramatization of that extraordinary place, there has to be an opportunity for us to reflect on how individuals are going to benefit from our collective accomplishment of getting to this extraordinary place. And then there are stories, and these are the stories that are told now throughout the journey, of the behaviors that will get us there. How do we need to act to go from where we are today to get to where we're headed, to get to this better place, presumably as the leader is beginning to put some specificity to this better place. The leader is out listening to folks in the organization. The leader is out there trialing various versions of this better place that we're going and listening to the responses, so that when the leader now declares this is where we're going, people are already buying into that a little bit because they've had an opportunity to participate in the identification of this better place. And as the leader is out into the organization sharing ideas about this better place, the leader is also alert to early examples of the behaviors that are going to get us there. So the leader will have a quiver of behaviors already. And then as the story is told and as time passes and as the work is being done to get to this extraordinary place, the leader continually refreshes those stories by the behaviors that he's seen or she's seen within the organization as we move along. That's the three parts to an aspirational story. One more thing that I can share with you about aspirational stories is sometimes I tell them to myself, right? I tell myself my own aspirational story, and I actually began to do this when I was a young boy, when I was a young athlete. And I remember on a couple of occasions declaring to my father that I could accomplish a particular athletic feat before I could accomplish it. I don't recall if this was exactly how I put it, but I think it really captures what I'm talking about, is I would tell my father I could hit 7 out of 10 free throws before I could hit 7 out of 10 free throws, because I had this youthful understanding, this young understanding, that by putting that story out there, by showing by declaring my aspiration, that it was more likely that I was going to accomplish it, right? It's out there now, and it's holding me to its accomplishment. I'm now driven to accomplish that because I've put that idea out into the world. So let me just mention one more time, folks, as we wind down here, yes, indeed, my very first novel, The 53rd Parallel, it was an international bestseller in the historical literary fiction category. If you know at all about novel sales, you know that the historical literary fiction category is one of the lowest selling categories there is out there. So to be the best seller in that category means you had to sell 2.5 books. But yes, the summer came out. It was an international bestseller for much of that summer. 99 cents, The 53rd Parallel on Amazon.com. And next week, folks, I'm so excited about coming back here for my 150th show and talking to you about love, how much I love you, how much I love the folks I'm working, and the importance of love in your creative life. I hope you have a wonderful week.
This has been Exploring Your Creative Genius on 97.9 The Hill. You can listen to other episodes on chapelboro.com.